Welcome, friends, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me scaling the rickety ladder and scanning the shelves of the Worst Foot Apothecary. Whether you're after tincture of unicorn testicle, phoenix vomit, powdered chimera talon, or the essence of Piers Morgan's soul, we've got all manner of bona fide ingredients to help you shake off your grubby humours. And joining me is a man who is one part water to a million parts wit and trivia, the encyclopedic reverse homeopath, Barry McStay.
I feel like, rather appropriately, listeners, you'll be glad to know that you can't see this. I've got quite a poorly eye today as we record this. So I've suddenly had a wonder as to what Pliny the Elder would recommend for a sty.
Probably recommend stabbing yourself in the eye with a gladiator's javelin.
Yeah. It does feel a bit like that's what's happened to me. I'm turning my face away from the camera as we have the Zoom call as much as possible to hide my shame.
Yeah, basically, while we are performing that most 21st century of art forms, the podcast, Barry very much resembles a beleaguered medieval peasant.
Yeah. Did you ever in school have people who were they were being treated for, you know, short sightedness or anything, and they had a patch over one eye?
Yeah.
I always wanted to be that kid.
Really?
Yes. Oh my God. Because of the, obviously, I assumed as a asthmatic 13-year-old with an eye patch was basically a pirate. That was
yeah. We were. I mean, going to school in the sort of, I'm sure there were kids sort of around at school in the back end of the 80s where there were cures that were forced upon them that were really debunked in the 50s, but our local GP couldn't be asked to update what they were doing to them.
Yeah, that's I like that. And whenever I would like fall down or bang my head or something as a kid, my mum would give us literally a spoonful of sugar, which, God bless, I mean, good for the shock and all, but God bless it, for the next 3-4 hours, I was like, you'd wound up one of those toys and just set it running around and around in circles on the floor,
yeah,
in front of her.
And then bang your head some more.
Yeah, exactly. The home medicines are the best.
Well, I mean, you say that. Home medicine of the 20th century, bit of sugar. Home medicine of the 19th century, bit of morphine.
Home medicine of the 21st century, no to medicine, kill all doctors. Obviously, footnote, get your vaccines, guys. Our guest this week is a writer and journalist who, in his own words, jumps between things like popular history, jokes, debunking, and product development. His book, Humans, A Brief History of How We Fucked It All Up, is a history of failure, is an international bestseller, and has been translated into 20 languages. The podcast, Worst Foot Forward, the podcast all about failure, was for a week ranked as the 17th most popular podcast in Luxembourg, and occasionally we say things in intelligible English. His second book, Truth, A Brief History of Total Bullshit, is a history of lies and other forms of nonsense, or so he says. He's currently working on his third book, A History of Conspiracy Theories, which will be published in March 2022, or so he says. He's recently also been the editor of Full Fact, the UK's independent fact-checking organisation, where he led a team through Brexit, a general election and a pandemic, and Ben and I have never been more anxious about presenting our facts and trivia than we are today. In his time, he's also been a journalist, worked in TV and done a little bit of comedy, and he was also editorial director of BuzzFeed UK, developing, among other things, hugely viral new quiz formats. So we're about to find out which kind of these seven podcast guest types he is. Please welcome Tom Phillips.
Hello there.
Hello, good to have you on board,
That's
Tom.
Lovely to be here, thank you.
Well done for weaponising failure in a way that we have so far failed to do.
I would like to say that the best thing about that was that missed out on being a top 10 bestseller in the UK by one copy.
No way.
And guess what I didn't do that week?
I
didn't buy a copy myself. So, yeah. Missed out to Dolly Alderton.
Clearly don't have enough extended family members you can sort of send a group text to go, everybody.
Look, ultimately, I think Alderton just wanted it more, you know. Sort of. It's,
yeah.
at this kind of high level, you know, it's all about those small margins and, you know, yeah, I've got lessons to learn, really.
Yeah. How did you find the process of creating a book about failure? And we will already have our own theory about this, but why do you think that a book on that subject was so appealing to people?
I mean, it came out sort of about halfway through the Trump presidency, during the Brexit negotiations. I think there were a lot of people who were, sort of minded to sort of consider the possibility that as humans, we are kind of primed to screw things up. It was really popular in Poland, a country that, for fairly obvious reasons, has quite a mordant sense of humour. It was really weird. I went over to Poland to do a thing, and they were just like, "Tell us your wisdom." And I'm like, "I was making jokes. It was just jokes."
Like some sort of savant.
It was like, you're writing a book about failure and just going, I'm going to screw this up, I'm going to get it wrong, it's going to be terrible. I was basically just crying and praying all the way through it.
Yeah.
I liked the fact that with the book, the design for it was very much taking the piss out of Yuval Noah Harari.
Yes. Yeah, it was. I think actually the publisher wanted it to just be a straight up parody of that to begin with, and then we kind of just like went, no, how about if it was actually a book in its own right? I don't know how many copies it sold because people thought they were buying Sapiens, but
you're like those guys who what do we call them, mockbusters, the people who make their version of Tangled.
Yes,
but it's just a waft of blonde hair off down the front of a tower on a DVD cover. Yes. Called Intertangled, and they just sell it at the checkout at Tesco's.
It's very much the snakes on a train of a history, really. It's
my gosh. So listen, we found out you're very good at failure. What are you worst at in the world?
I'm terrible at loads of things, but I think really it's organizing stuff, which is not ideal when sometimes your career's been involved in organizing things. I'm like, specifically birthday parties, my own birthday parties. I just do this thing where I go like, oh, this year I'm going to organize a birthday party. I'm going to do it really well. I'm going to plan ahead of time, get invites out, tell people on Facebook and email, whatever, WhatsApp. I'm going to tell them like weeks and weeks in advance and all that. And I never, ever do. I either forget to book somewhere or I forget to tell people, or I manage to do both. I think my record is 1 year, I did book a place and then I forgot to tell anybody at all about that until 4 hours before it started.
That is strong.
Yeah, I can imagine you filming a music video there of "It's My Birthday and I'll Cry If I Want To," a really maudlin, slow John Lewis Christmas advert.
There was a lovely sort of 45 minutes at the beginning of it as I just sat in a pub at like big long table on my own reading a book, and I was just like, any minute now they're going to bring me like a sort of a little cupcake with one candle in it,
Firstly, you must have found the pandemic a great relief that you didn't have to organize any birthday parties for a couple of years.
It was amazing. And I'm absolutely convinced myself that I am going to organize my 3 birthday parties that I'm due, and I'm actually going to do it this year. So maybe I'll organize that one 6 hours in advance.
I mean, yeah. That's an invite I want to see, like Tom Phillips, the trilogy.
Yeah. When I was 21, my parents were having a 21st birthday party is obviously quite a big deal, certainly in the UK and Ireland. So my parents were like, oh, we'll have a 21st for you. And I put it off so long that I had my 21st birthday party a week after my 22nd birthday. So the invites went out saying you were cordially invited to Barry's 21st /1.
Sorry, so was your birthday party an homage to Tristram Shandy?
Yes. Yeah, people didn't appreciate when I turned up as a black page, though. Which is a reference that only the 7 people who've read Tristram Shandy will get.
Yes.
It also, my birthday party also started and I hadn't been born yet.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think we have leaned too far into this very niche joke that I wish I hadn't started.
No, guys, come back for the strong Tristram Shandy references.
Oh my God, you said Tristram Randy. And
which is the Snakes on a Train version of it.
Yeah.
Well, no, I was going to say it was the pornography version where it starts with him orgasming and then works backwards from there.
Well, I just thought I'd get Pliny out of the way first. We talk about him so often on the podcast that, you know, we don't need to dwell very long on him, but I'm just going to throw out a few more of Pliny's homemade remedies for everybody. If you've got corns on your feet, what goes well with corn? It's beef suet. So he suggests putting beef suet and frankincense on your corns. Also, for corns and calluses, fresh dung from wild boars or pigs. And for sciatica, it's goat's dung. You want to boil some goat's dung under your big toe. And he also reckons that if you cut a corn or a callus when you see a falling star, it'll cure it really quickly. Yeah.
So does he give any reasoning behind this claim?
No, it's Pliny the Elder, Ben. Come on. Don't go up. At this point, nearly 250 episodes into our podcast, don't finally say, Pliny the Elder, we want to see your workings.
I sort of feel like Pliny put his book together by just having a dartboard with animals around the outside, astronomical events round the middle, and then in the bullseye was just various bodily fluids, and you throw a couple of darts and go, yeah, that seems like a cure.
Yeah, bullseye, coincidentally enough, a cure for headaches.
Yeah, of course. of course.
Yeah, no, he also actually, for a toothache, he says a mouse is to be eaten twice a month. So an apple a day keeps the doctor away, a mouse twice monthly keeps toothache away. And for headache, apply the forehead to the mud obtained by pouring vinegar over a front door's hinges. Not a back door, a front door. Very important.
Okay.
He also recommends for headache, wrapping the rope used by a suicide around your temples. I think he's just discovered that occasionally applying pressure to the temples can be good to help relieve headache if you're finding pressure points.
Yeah, like, have you not heard of a poultice, Pliny?
Yeah, basically, yes. He actually, elsewhere in his book, he actually says, I find that headaches are relieved by tying a woman's bra on my head. So, for the generic public, he says, the rope used by a suicide. Pliny, personally, is saying that he uses a woman's bra. Now, a bra in that time would have just been like a wrap of cloth or something like that. But he could have just saying a wrap of cloth rather than a woman's bra.
I'm sorry, I can't get over the image of Pliny the Elder in a toga with a wonder bra on his head going around going, you there, rub some goat dung on your testicles.
Was this just like a really, really creepy chat-up technique? Like, he's just going up to somebody just going like, oh, I've got a really bad headache. I don't suppose I could ask... Could I just, yeah. You know, could you just pop it off and I'll only be 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Amy Richland wrote an essay in 1997 called Pliny's Brassiere, Roman Medicine and the Female Body. And she suggested that actually Pliny thought that something is exuded from women's body that would make a brassiere cure a headache. It's weirdly creepy to specifically say he needs a woman's bra. Also in creepy women's medicine, the Hoopers, Dr. Hooper. Dr. Hooper patented Hooper's female pills in 1743. Hooper's female pills were supposedly used to cure disorders peculiarly incident to the female sex, as well as opening obstructions of vessels.
This doesn't sound good.
Well, the Hoopers, these doctors were male midwives, and apparently these pills were meant to be, you know, restore the constitution of married women after lying in. So following childbirth, these are meant to help restore women to full vitality. Some suggest, modern historians suggest, they may have been pills to deal with unwanted pregnancies. But in other suggestions, it's basically, it's just a sort of a generic cure-all type pill that was aimed specifically at women. And they were very popular. They were still being produced in the early 20th century. One other medicine that's lasted a very long time is gin and tonic. I didn't realise this, but then oddly, I've heard this twice in the last 2 days. Yeah, the quinine in gin and tonic was used to help treat malaria. Another cocktail ingredient emerged from treating a classic Enlightenment disease. Gout. So gout typically strikes joints, the big toe or the thumb. And 18th century physicians understood that it might move around the body, could cause headaches and heart palpitations. And also, it was quite like a fashionable disease to have. Obviously, agonisingly painful. But if you had gout, it probably meant that you were eating and drinking quite well. You'd reached a certain level of luxury and comfort in your life. The medieval cure for gout was you'd take an owl, pluck it clean, open it, clean and salt it, put it in a new pot, cover it with a stone, put it in an oven, let it stand till it be burnt, and then stamp it with boar's grease and anoint the gout therewith.
Are you sure you're not just reading from Blumenthal's new cookbook?
Yeah. No, the 18th century doctors moved on a little bit from that. They saw, they sort of agreed with one doctor called George Chain. He saw gout as a result of blood beginning to stagnate in the extremities. Because it was in the extremities of the body, he thought it was the blood had reached the extremities and was sort of just sitting there. And you would think, oh, maybe bleeding would be the way that you would treat it. But no, mm-hmm. Instead, they recommended, actually fairly smartly, a light diet, plenty of fluids. That's pretty good for gout. And regular doses of a digestive remedy that he called bitters. Distilled alcohol infused with watercress, horseradish, wormwood, and angelica root. This is suggested by a doctor called Thomas Sydenham, the 17th century English Hippocrates. And Sydenham's bitters became very popular to treat gout. And in 1712, a recipe for Stoughton's Elixir, developed by the Reverend Richard Stoughton, was basically a different form of bitters. It became one of the first British medicines to receive a royal patent. Patents in medicine have been around a lot longer in the UK than have been in America, which we'll come on to very shortly. But Stoughton's bitters began to be exported around the world into the colonies, and after the War of Independence, there were distillers in Boston began to produce it. In 1783, a French officer called Nicolas Houssain began to sell bitters, including an extract of meadow saffron, one of the components of which, colchicine, is now known to block the metabolic pathways that cause gout. So actually, it worked. But also, people went, this tastes really good when you mix it with cheap gin. And so there were loads of these things going around, like, you know, commercial versions of nostrums and bitters. And you had Dr. Radcliffe's purging elixir and Bateman's pectoral drops and Daffy's elixir is one of the famous ones. But they also found, as I said, that bitters tasted really good with gin. And then, during the 19th century, a lot of Western soldiers and sailors going to the colonies, extreme tropical climates, and they wanted to drink, you know, similar to gin and tonic, a mixed drink that would help them adjust to the extremes of the climates. And so you had bitters being produced specifically for these people by Peychaud, one company, and Angostura. They're the two companies that still today make the most popular bitters used in cocktails. Peychaud's bitters were sold around the world, but British drinkers tend to prefer the bitters developed by a German doctor called Johann Gottlieb Benjamin Siegert. And he went to South America and served with Simon Bolivar and settled in the Venezuelan port of Angostura, now known as Ciudad Bolivar. And he saw the opportunity to have, you know, make bitters on in situ for the, I was about to say the locals, for the colonial locals. And he marketed it as a treatment for seasickness. And by 1830, he was making enough money to set up a whole factory, then officers in the Navy ships would pick up the tonic and bring it around the world. And yeah, by the 1840s, they were drinking their favourite Plymouth gin with a dash of Angostura bitters, or a pink gin, as we now know it today. I'm going to come on to my favourite worst in a second. After I just was reading from some medieval treatments, and there was one that stood out. If you have a burn, take a live snail and rub its slime against the burn. And it will heal. Now, I don't know if you've ever stood on a snail or a slug, because I have, and it's you feel like unclean for days afterwards. but medieval doctors suggested that rubbing a live snail and its slime against the burn would heal it, and turns out, it's one of those that was right. Reduce blistering, apparently because snail slime has antioxidants, antiseptics, anesthetics, anti-irritants, anti-inflammatory qualities, they're antibiotic, and they have antiviral properties, as well as having collagen and elastin, which help promote skin repair.
Why don't we just use them for everything?
Good question, Tom. Modern science now uses a thing called snail gel as a skin preparation and for treating minor injuries.
I mean, what I want to happen is if you have a burn, then you take the snail, you put it on there, there is a hissing noise and steam rises from underneath the snail.
Yeah. Or you have to put the snail just above the cut with a bit of lettuce the other side of the cut and you lure it over the course of an hour to inch its way over the cut.
Yeah, and in the way that, because you know that there's also, there's maggot therapy, isn't there, to sort of help get rid of dead flesh. So obviously, if you've got like, I can't remember what the order is, but a first degree burn, which is, I presume they're not very bad, it's just a tiny little snail. But if it's a fifth degree burn, you get an African land snail and his mates, which is like the size of a cat, and it slithers over you.
But speaking of slithering, my world's worst medicine is snake oil. So I started out researching this by wanting to find out about where the term snake oil comes from as an idea that was used as a, you know, a quack elixir or people trying to sell frauds. A snake oil salesman is considered to be a fraud. And the term comes from snake oil that used to be sold as a cure-all elixir, particularly in the 19th century in the United States. But the original snake oil is a Chinese treatment. An oil from Chinese water snakes has been used for centuries, apparently, in Chinese traditional medicine to treat joint pain, like arthritis and so on. And it works. It works. Chinese river snakes have a very high concentration of omega-3 and fatty acids and things like that. More than that is contained in salmon, for instance. And so when a lot of Chinese railway labourers moved to the United States in the 19th century, they brought some of their traditional treatments with them. And so people in America saw them treating their aches and pains and thought, wow, snake oil really works on arthritis. And so they began chopping up rattlesnakes and things like that. Rattlesnakes do not contain a significant amount of omega-3, probably because they're land-dwelling as opposed to water-dwelling and they're not having to process their bodily functions through water. More recent science has proven that, again, this stuff does work. Erebu sea snake oil is found to be able to improve the ability of mice to learn mazes in modern studies. Their swimming endurance improves. So snake oil, the right type of snake oil, can be beneficial. But right, not the weird cure-all panaceas that were being sold in 19th and early 20th century America. And, you know, patent medicines were used by a lot of people to mask things with, like, addictive qualities like cocaine and amphetamines and alcohol. So you might have people swearing by their Vandevelle's cure-all elixir, but it's probably because they're getting massively high off it week in, week out. But there were no federal regulations in the US concerning the effectiveness of drugs and so on until 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Act. And so people were able to sell whatever they wanted in the USA for a lot longer than they were in Europe and claim it was a medicine. Enter Clark Stanley, the Rattlesnake King. And already, like, the name doesn't sound promising, but the first line of his Wikipedia says he was born circa 1854 in Abilene, Texas, according to himself. The town was founded in 1881. So, or maybe not the most trustworthy source. And he worked as a cowboy for quite a long time. And in the late 1870s, he said that he gave up cowboying to begin to study for a couple of years with a Hopi medicine man in Arizona to learn the secrets of snake oil. He specifically went down the Native American medicine shamanistic route because we were at the height of the Yellow Peril at this point. So marketing anything, where there was a lot of, you know, anti-Chinese sentiment in America, so marketing anything as a Chinese-inspired medicine was not considered commercially viable. So he went, oh, I'm going to take this Chinese medicine thing, pretend it's a Native American thing, and then with the help of a Boston druggist, he began marketing his product, his snake oil, at medicine shows around the country, taking his whole circus act on the road, where he would reach into a bag in front of a crowd of people beside a wagon, grab a rattlesnake, pull it out, cut its head off, squeeze it, and then plunge it into some boiling water. And he'd let it cook in there, and then he'd skim the top off the water and say, that was the miracle elixir, that was the remedy on top of the water. And he'd put it into a little bottle, and he labelled it snake oil and sold it for 50 cents, or about $20 a bottle. And it was said to cure aches and pains and arthritis and animal bites and scratches and inflammation, anything you like. And he became a sensation touring around the country to the extent that he took this act to the Chicago World's Fair in 1893.
What? And so at the Chicago World's Fair, where there were people demonstrating some of the most sophisticated modern technology, up to and including our pal Nikola Tesla,
yep,
you had a man beheading rattlesnakes.
Yeah, and we've mentioned the World's Fair several times on the podcast in the past. I don't think, if people don't realise, the World's Fair lasted from May to October. It wasn't like a weekend event. So Stanley will have decapitated, he will have decapitated hundreds of snakes.
Well, that'll have, do you know what? I imagine a young Henry Ford watching him with his production line of decapitated rattlesnakes and thought, that gives me an idea.
Yeah. You can have any colour so long as it rattles. but this like helped him take off. He went on to establish factories in Beverly, in Massachusetts, and Providence in Rhode Island. Obviously, though, the problem with that as well is that you do the World's Fair for 5 or 6 months, you're going to get the attention of the authorities as well. And so he was basically then being watched by the government. And Clark Stanley's snake oil liniment was tested by the Bureau of Chemistry, the precursor to the FDA as it is now today, in 1916. And it was found to contain mineral oil, 1% fatty oil, assumed to be tallow, taken from beef fat, capsicum from chili peppers, turpentine, camphor, and no snake product.
Snakeless snake oil.
Yeah. There is a suggestion from some people who I think are being generous.
Sorry, I realise I said the word snakeless snake oil and my brain added Batman to the end of that.
Snakeless snake oil Batman. Some generous people suggest that maybe the mass production just made it impossible for him to put snake oil in every bottle of his stuff.
Well, that's the problem with hucksters these days, that they're not just making artisanal snake oil, it's mass-produced.
Well, also, he'd used up all of his snakes at the World Fair.
Yeah, exactly.
He'd gone through them.
Yeah, yeah. Rattlesnakes, you only ever see them in films these days, it's because of Clark Stanley. They've been extinct in America for 100 years and we never knew. Yeah, he faced federal prosecution in a 1916 civil hearing. He pleaded nolle contendere, or no contest, to the allegations against him, not admitting guilt, but his plea was accepted and he was fined $20 or $476 in today's money, which seems not enough. But as a result of the sensation around the trial and everything, the term snake oil salesman has now been bequeathed to generations hereafter to stand for hucksters and fraudsters and shysters. So I'm going to suggest Clark Stanley's rattlesnake snake oil as the world's worst medicine.
I looked at Hadacol, which is one of the other famous sort of patent medicines, which again, really only sold because it was 12% alcohol. It didn't do anything else. And the guy was fairly open about that. Like, the joke of it was like, why is it called Hadacol? And he said, a Hadacol, it's something. It was very much taking that sort of P.T. Barnum, like, I am scamming you and you enjoy it kind of approach to this. I also looked at asthma cigarettes, which were really big in sort of like the 1880s, 1890s, earlier sort of thing, which were basically, you have asthma, have you considered smoking some cigarettes?
In answer to that, my 14-year-old self would say, yes.
Yes, exactly. In 1901, Marcel Proust wrote a letter to his mother in which he said, yesterday after I wrote to you, I had an attack of asthma, which obliged me to walk all doubled up and light anti-asthma cigarettes at every tobacconist's I passed.
Tobacconist he passed.
Every single one. It's like,
but like tobacconist is like corner shop.
Yeah.
So corner shops are 10 a penny. Marcel Proust was 100 a day man that day.
Yeah, exactly. And
he won't be smelling any bloody Madeleines after that.
Yeah.
and like as with all of these things, like there was a little something to it. Like these special sort of, like this was also at the time that like cigarettes were just beginning sort of mass production themselves. So like I was saying, it was a big deal. The anti-asthma cigarettes, they did have like sort of extracts of a plant leaf, stramonium, which is kind of part of the nightshade family, and like all of the nightshade family, like deadly nightshade, henbane, mandrake, all of these kinds of things, like it is quite psychoactive. In fact, it can be a hallucinogen sort of in the right concentration, but it also does actually kind of work to sort of relieve respiratory things. So like these cigarettes did have something that possibly might actually help with asthma in it. Unfortunately, the delivery mechanism was cigarettes, which, not great. Not great for this. No. So I looked at that. I looked briefly at sort of like some other bits in the history of medicine. I'm a huge fan of, do you know Edwin Catsky? It's one of the best examples of experimental practice in the history of medicine. This was in 1936, and it was sort of at the time when like sort of anaesthetics was kind of sort of on the rise, and particularly local anaesthetics. And they'd come across a really good local anaesthetic that had a really good effect for sort of numbing, like just sort of part of your, you know, part of your body, which was cocaine.
Yeah, big. Applied like just in a powder to the skin,
well, or injected, you know, sort of kind of topically. Okay. Like, you know, so you can put it on topically, you can inject it, you can take it in the traditional manner.
Yeah, and all my friends are used to have gummy.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I understand.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I'm told it does have a numbing effect. I wouldn't know, obviously. So there was a doctor who wanted to test out exactly what the effects of this were. And so in 1936, he decided to inject himself with a huge amount of cocaine. And he then spent his last evening on Earth scrawling research notes in almost illegible writing on the wall of his lab, and then died.
Oh my God! Wow.
And some quotes from the decipherable parts of his of his wall notes include: I drank one can of beer previous to medication.
Oh no!
The word paralysis, which, in the words of the New York Times report of his death at the time, paralysis was followed by a wavy, illegible scrawl that ran almost to the floor. The words partial recovery, smoked.
Please tell me he didn't finish writing those words out fully.
No. Partial recovery, smoked cigarette. Which.
Died of sudden onset lung cancer.
Which, I think, if we're honest, I think we've all had nights where we've had that moment of partial recovery, smoked cigarette, before it all went catastrophically wrong. And then. Amongst his last words were probably, it was difficult to tell because his notes were all out of order because he was clearly just running around the lab in different places, scrawling over. But one of his last ones was probably, advise all inquisitive MDs to lay off this stuff. So yes.
Speedballing, not recommended
not ideal,
by the American
no,
Medical Association.
Not experimental best practice, it turned out. Anyway, so those were the things I looked at, but the thing I decided on was the career of roughly, you know, it's also sort of the early part of the 20th century, the career of Dr., not a doctor, John R. Brinkley.
Yes!
He's back! He's back!
I didn't listen to the doctor's one. Was he on that? Yes!
He
brilliant.
Is our favourite. Absolute favourite.
I'm so glad.
Now, for listeners who haven't listened to our entire back catalogue, perhaps your more recent joinees to the podcast, over 50 episodes, over 200 episodes ago, we did this guy, so strap in.
So, Doctor, not a doctor, John R. Brinkley, John Romulus Brinkley, which is one of my favourite things about him, is that his middle name was Romulus. He wasn't a doctor. He tried very... The thing that's quite affecting about the story is he tried really hard to become an actual doctor. Like, his dad was a doctor. He felt this was his calling in life. He was rejected from Johns Hopkins. He then went and tried and found a sort of a medical school from the eclectic school of medicine, which for modern listeners meant bollocks.
Appropriately enough, given his future career.
Exactly. No spoilers now. But he couldn't even graduate from the nonsense medical school because he was going through a messy divorce with his wife, and he wasn't allowed to graduate without paying his fees, and he didn't have any money. But he did find that Kansas, the State Board of Kansas, had quite lax regulations around who they would admit as a licensed doctor. And the fact that he was, despite the fact that he hadn't graduated, the fact that he was studying at this allowed him to get like a provisional license, which then he was able to take to other states as well and go like, well, look, I'm licensed in Kansas, so that's fine. And the thing about this is, once again, like, he really wanted to be a doctor, and he moves to Kansas. It sets up in this little sort of, you know, this little tiny out of the way town that his second wife, when she saw it, she burst into tears because it was... His moving to Kansas actually coincided with the flu epidemic of sort of 1918, during which, by all accounts, he actually did a really, really good job of treating the townspeople. So, like, he kind of had some skills as a doctor, and, like, throughout his career, he was kind of, like, noted for, like, being really generous to everybody who he wasn't scamming. So, like... As we'll get on to, he was scamming a huge number of people, but he was also providing genuine medical care to, like, poor people for free. But it's shortly after this that he comes up with his masterstroke, which is a local farmer comes to him and basically goes, like, Doctor, I'm impotent. The exact words...
The world's worst doctor joke. Well,
yeah. the exact words that he used was... As it reportedly was, no pep, flat tire. just going through sort of old-timey, you know, euphemisms for impotence there.
Thankfully, John R. Brinkley didn't recommend that he try blow it back up again.
Exactly. Just gotta crank you up and swap in a spare. Yeah. It'll, you know.
I just gotta pop the hood.
anyway, so like, you know, the only records of this are from Brinkley's own accounts, which are probably nonsense. But at some point, one of them comes up with the notion that the best solution to impotence is to transplant goat testicles into the man's scrotum. I don't know why that's what you come up with. I mean, obviously, like, goats kind of have this, like, sort of folkloric kind of association with being sort of randy and, you know, they're a symbol of virility and they're kind of devilish. But still, they're goats. Like...
Do we know if this farmer was a goat farmer?
So, yes, he was, apparently. Yes.
By sheer coincidence, they saw a chance for synergy.
Also, Brinkley, earlier in his career, had taken a job at, like, a sort of a plant where he was, like, basically just stitching up, in both senses of the word, the plant employees. But they had a bunch of animals, and so he was able to study animals, and he got really into goats at the time. So he already kind of had, like, a certain kind of, like, goats are an interesting creature sort of thing working away at the back of his mind. Anyway, he performs this operation. It is... a success, in the sense that, obviously... impotence can be quite heavily psychological. This man reported that it had absolutely, you know, it had given him 25 years of his life back, that he was, you know, he was sort of skipping around and shagging away and it was all perfect. So Brinkley does it again. And this is the next...
Brinkley, you've done it again.
Once more.
Do you know, Tom, what the child of the first man he operated on was called?
I do, but it wasn't the first. It was this is the second time. This is the first guy just shagged loads. This the second one is the one that history records as being this one. Because, and in this one, it's not just the guy, who's a guy called William Sitsforth, I believe his name was. According to at least one book that I've read on this subject, Brinkley also transplanted a goat's ovary into his wife.
Oh... I did not know that, and that is that goes from hey lads, do the silliest things to absolute horror show.
So, yeah, like at this point, this is serial killer behavior. This is, you know, but yes. So yes, once again, the operation is supposedly a success, and they have a kid. Like less than a year later, they have a kid, which is basically taken as
a human child, not a kid. Well, just to be clear for our listeners,
by all accounts, not a terrifying goat human hybrid. The kid is of course called Billy. He led a long and apparently healthy life. He was interviewed by the Kansas City Star about 60 years later, and he said that actually his dad had always said that he'd gone in for prostate problems, and he hadn't even gone in for impotence or infertility or anything like that. He just got in for a prostate problem, and Brinkley had talked him into, well, how about I put goat balls in your scrotum? Would that work?
Ironically, that feels like Billy is trolling his dad.
I mean, given that Billy, as a child, was then put in adverts and was pictured being held by Brinkley, who, it's important to get across what Brinkley looked like, is he looked like a sort of, like, serial killer version of Colonel Sanders. Like, he had, like...
That's so perfect.
Like, he had, like, sort of, like, he had the sort of the southern gentleman, you know, the white suit, the little white goatee, all that sort of thing. But he also had the little round glasses and slicked back hair and just an air about him of going, like, someone who's going to go, like, I want to cut you up and put balls in you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I imagine at the end of every operation, he'd put the goat ball in the ball sack, and then just before he... sewed it up, he'd have to sprinkle something in there. He goes, what's that? My secret herbs and spices.
This was the start of a massive publicity blitz that he goes on, going like, look, it produced a child, the world's first goat gland baby. And the thing about Brinkley is he was a terrible, terrible doctor, but he was an incredible advertising man. He basically pioneered a huge amount of like modern American media. And he basically set up his own radio station, which he used to broadcast across Kansas to basically drum up business, you know. And in doing so, he would, you know, not just advertise the goat gland business, he would also diagnose people who phoned in and wrote in and stuff like that. He would just, you know, he was utterly reckless, but he would also just, like, run a radio station. And he kind of, like, he goes through this. My favourite things about him is that, like... This all starts to cut, like, he also, like, is, you know, like, there are famous people. He comes quite close to treating the former president at one point, like, mm-hmm. like Woodrow Wilson was supposedly interested in it, but Brinkley demanded a special train be put on for him to go to Washington to treat him. The dean of the Chicago Law School gives, you know, gets the treatment and gives him an honorary doctorate in science because he's so pleased with how well the treatment's gone. Brinkley becomes a millionaire.
Sorry, the dean of a law school gave him a doctorate in
science.
Which,
given how this story ends up, is quite ironic. Because, like, this starts to go wrong. As Brinkley becomes a millionaire, he starts to attract attention. There's a big sort of series of investigative reports by the Kansas City Star, which I would like to say was because they were fearless crusading journalists. No, it's because, on the one hand, his radio station had been given a license to up its wattage where their local radio station had been denied, and also a bunch of their advertisers were patent medicine companies who were going, this guy's killing us, we're going to have to pull our advertising because we haven't got any money left unless you take him down. So, you know, but nonetheless, the American Medical Association also kind of is taking an interest at this point. So, like, in 1930, sort of within the space of a couple of months, you have both the AMA pulls his medical license, and sort of the radio authority pulls his radio license. At which point, what does he do? What would you do if you're being kind of like chucked out of both medicine and broadcasting at the same time?
Keep doing medicine and broadcasting.
And run for governor of Kansas. And the thing about this again is he should have won. It's only because his opponents got them to put in basically a kind of bullshit rule that his name had to be written as J.R. Brinkley and no other form of his name was allowed. This cost him about 30 to 50,000 votes. He would have won without it.
I think that we got to say, basically, if he'd have won that, given his career trajectory and ambition and ability with self-promotion, he absolutely would have been America's wartime president.
Yes, exactly.
That's what we managed to avoid.
This is how close it got, because, yes, he was... You know, his next step, of course, is to basically pioneer a whole new type of radio, because he moves to Texas, moves to sort of the Rio Grande border area, sets up in Del Rio on one side of the Rio Grande, and builds what at one point was the most powerful radio transmitter in the world on the other side of the Rio Grande in Mexico, from where he can broadcast to the entirety of the United States. Like, people in New York were complaining that they couldn't get any other radio station because his radio transmitter was so powerful.
He's got a real sort of Kentucky Fried Bond villain vibe about him at this stage.
Like he's gone to Mexico, built the world's biggest radio transmitter, where, by the way, he helps make country music nationally popular.
Yeah, his greatest sin.
You know, because like it was like local bluegrass music was popular in the area, but it wasn't like sort of this sort of nationwide thing. But he had, you know, he had like the Carter Family, he had all of these big upcoming acts on and made it nationally popular. He also got into Nazi propaganda, which again, yes, that's a good reason why he wasn't a wartime president. You know, he hosts like Gerald Winrod, who's like one of the sort of the foundational conspiracy theorists, a guy called, he was known as the Jayhawk Nazi. Because he was a Nazi. And like he's one of the guys who was sort of absolutely essential in spreading the Illuminati conspiracy theory through America.
Are you saying that somebody with access to new media was bringing on sensationalist gadflies to try and up their profile?
Someone who has an uncanny ability to understand the ebb and flow of a new media technology, who flirts with both demagogic right-wing politics and medical misinformation, I cannot think of any. It's a shame, because really it's something like this, you want some kind of like resonance with the modern day, but it's just
it's a shame we don't live in a terminal time loop of humanity,
just not
isn't it?
I don't want to stretch things though, but
Do we have any evidence that Donald Trump's father suffered from impotence, visited John R. Brinkley, and had some goat testicles swimming around his Trumpian ballsack?
We have no evidence of this that I'm aware of, but I nonetheless, now you've said it, choose to believe that it's true.
Yeah.
Answered like a former chief executive of Full Fact.
That is my guy, the goat gland doctor. One of my favourite quotes from him is, "You're only as old as your glands," which is not true. And another one, which is, "All energy is sex energy," which
that's a Prince B-side, isn't it?
I don't know what it means, but it's a great quote.
Oh, it's got to be the future of renewables, though.
You could power a town with that guy's lust.
Yeah.
I love it. We heard it here first. Worst Foot Forward says, "Let's fuck the world green." which is, of course, a Kermit the Frog B-side.
That was his collaboration with Peaches, right? That was, yeah.
Yeah. There have understandably been many attempts to cure cancer and the hope that something will appear that will be a catch-all, a silver bullet. And in the 70s and 80s, there was a popularity for using shark cartilage to try and cure cancer. And
did cancer deaths fall, but shark deaths rose exponentially?
Have we basically created the trolley problem with cancer and sharks? The notion was, essentially, and when I say this out loud, it doesn't seem like the most robust of sciences. Sharks don't get cancer, so let's use their cartilage. So essentially, in the 70s and 80s, the market got flooded with shark cartilage supplements. There were pills, liquids, creams. You could even have, brace yourself, gentlemen, a shark cartilage enema.
No, and you couldn't.
Apparently so. Now, I thankfully don't know too much about enemas, but what I'm led to understand about them, quite liquid, and shark cartilage, quite spongy. But
is this just the fallout from the popularity of Jaws?
Did you enjoy this film? Have you thought about sticking it up your arse?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the movie tie-in that I think Spielberg was dreaming of.
Right, there's going to be fridge magnets, there's going to be pencil cases, there's going to be stickers, and there's going to be enemas. What did you say? Enemas. You heard me. Enemas. Shark enemas.
Funnily enough, in the mid-90s, there was a small part of the medical community that suggested that T-Rex cartilage could also cure cancer. So that sort of caught my eye as a particularly grisly thing. I also had a look at the popularity of radiation as a way of curing various ills. We've talked before about morphine and methamphetamine, but 100 years ago, people knew that radiation was powerful, and they presumed that it had strong medicinal purposes. So people would buy radium pendants, radon water, and even my favourite, uranium blankets, they believed would improve their digestion, their arthritis. A very popular product was called the radium or revigator, which was a water cooler which was lined with radioactive ore.
And heavy water cooler, I think you'll find, Ben.
Very nice. And it apparently would, in their words, the advertiser, enhance the drinking water with radon.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And this chap...
How are we still around as a species?
Yeah. I know, right? There's the most famous person who took it was a Pittsburgh steel industrialist called Eben Byers, who you may know, Barry, because he was apparently a very famous golfist of the early 1900s. And over a 30-year period, he ended up with holes in his skull alongside multiple cancers for, you know, drinking radioactive water.
Oh, my God.
I know. Disgusting, right?
Yeah. No, that's... Holes. There's something about holes in one, but I'm not there yet, Ben.
I mean, you've got it. That's what would happen if the Queen had drunk it.
Yeah.
But... my topic that I looked at broadly was, well, Barry, you have talked about imbibing animals, and Tom, you've talked about putting animals in you. I am going to go one step further and talk about medical anthropophagy, or in simpler terms, medical cannibalism.
Oh.
So... this is a notion that has existed for an awful long time. If you go back to Roman times, it was believed that the blood of great men, particularly the blood of gladiators, had medicinal properties. So you could gain vitality and even valor and bravery from drinking their blood. It had to be hot blood. So apparently at the Colosseum, when a gladiator was slain, epileptics would get out of the crowd, go to his corpse, and start sucking living blood from his open wound.
Wow, that is a hell of a pitch invasion.
Right? Well, it sort of makes me think that corner men in boxing are really sort of making it a lot more basic, which is their Vaseline and the little knuckle duster that moves the bruises around.
Yeah. Whereas, oh, God.
There was a Roman physician called Scribonius Largus who even said that if you ate the liver of a stag killed by a weapon used to vanquish a gladiator, that would cure your epilepsy. And this notion continued long into modern times, with a particular height in the 16th and 17th century. So after gladiatorial combat sort of went by the wayside as the Roman Empire converted to Christianity, people found an alternative in the blood of victims of executions. Oh, yeah. And this continued in Europe, particularly in the Germanic states and in Denmark. If there was an execution, then you have people lining up to drink their blood. And executioners, in the words of one academic, took on this role of sort of a social leper with almost magical powers. A lot of what I read came from a book with, I'll be honest, an absolute banger of a title called Mummies, Cannibals and Vampires, The History of Corpse Medicine from the Renaissance to the Victorians by a chap called Richard Sugg. And there's a great little anecdote he tells about a Franciscan monk who had his own apothecary, who talked about the benefits of eating the blood of the executed. And you might go, but you don't eat blood unless it's in the form of a black pudding. You could drink it. But if he said eating was a black pudding, no, it was not. He suggested turning the blood of the executed into marmalade.
Oh, good Lord. That is the... Paddington, please.
I know. The recipe is stir the blood to a batter with a knife, pound it through a sieve of finest silk.
Wow.
That's
what Brendan Gleeson's character is making before Paddington comes to the prison.
Oh, no!
Man, I ruined Paddington 2 for you, Ben.
That is the most incredible fan fiction. I love the thought that he's escaping with a horrifying Irish cannibal.
I mean, it's the franchise really deserves a gritty reboot, you know, like sort of just
It needs. Yeah. It's going to be bonded, like they did with the James Bond reboot. It suddenly gets a lot darker, deepest, darkest Peru.
Yeah. I'm Paddington.
Yeah. They get Quentin Tarantino in. They could also have Mr. Brown.
Yeah. Amazing. It wasn't just peasants going to public executions who adopted corpse medicine. It was considered for use and indeed used by royalty, priests, natural philosophies. Many of the greatest minds of the day believed that it had real use. Charles I became corpse medicine, obviously, because he was executed. And so, again, when he was executed, crowds rushed forward to wash their hands in his blood because the king's blood was thought to have magical powers. His son, and I didn't know this, you know, Charles of the Restoration, he was a skilled chemist. And he created his own tincture. He bought the recipe from a man called Jonathan Goddard, who was a physician, and the recipe was of something called Goddard's Drops. And they became known later as the King's Drops. And they contained 2 pounds of hartshorn, 2 pounds of dried viper, 2 pounds of ivory, and 5 pounds of human skull. And they were minced and distilled into a liquid. The skull was important because it was believed that the skull sort of trapped the spirit, particularly if it was someone who had died a violent and unexpected death. Then their spirit hadn't been able to ascend to heaven or descend to hell and was trapped within the actual structure of the bones.
Tell you what they needed. Uh-huh. Some radon water.
Yes, that would have sorted them out. Yeah.
Get a skylight in your skull.
You'll be unsurprised to know that this was really noxious stuff. And though it was popularly taken by a lot of people, famously, the English MP Sir Edward Walpole took the King's Drops to prevent his convulsions, but it actually made them even worse. And now medical historians think that they probably are what did for him. I'm going to make things even more disgusting now. Not only did people like the blood of kings and powdered skulls, there was even something called usnea. Now, usnea is the moss that grows on buried skulls, and that was considered to cure nosebleeds. And sometimes gym doctors would even soak bandages in it and then put it on the wounds. And this is the sort of the height of the authority goes to Paracelsus, a genuinely pioneering medic of the 17th century, was quoted as saying, "If doctors were aware of the power of this substance," referring to corpses, "no body would be left on the gibbet for more than 3 days." So, like, as far as he's concerned, this is the absolute business. One of his compatriots, Johann Schroeder, describes the best meat from humans as resembling smoke-cured meat without any stench. So he's basically gone to the next level and created a charcuterie board. So there were dissenting voices at this time, most famously of all, Michel de Montaigne, who is considered one of the most famous essayists of all time. He's like a real poster boy of the Enlightenment. And what I love about him, he's one of these men who was born out of time. The sophistication of his thought, it goes way beyond the late 16th century that he's writing in. And he doesn't just have a go at the notion of corpse medicine as not working. He has a go at it for the hypocrisy. Because what's happening in the 1580s when he's writing? Well, Europeans have already discovered the Americas. They are already travelling round to the actual East Indies and India, and are at the very least aware of more of Africa and even the notion of Australia than ever before. And they are populating them with anthropophagists, with cannibals, and making out that these people are subhuman beasts that we should either have revulsion or pity for. And yet, in the courts of Europe, we are consuming human bodies. Are we not ourselves cannibals, says Michel de Montaigne, which is an incredibly modern argument to go, how can we have a go at these people from the New World for being backward when we are doing the very same thing here? And that argument was progressed by several modern anthropologists, and I really like the notion. This is not to say that I'm about to become a proponent of medical cannibalism, but they've said that...
Says Ben, biting his fingernails.
Yeah. Oh, auto-cannibalism, very different thing.
Yeah.
That, broadly speaking, in non-European cultures, when cannibalism has been said to occur, it is very specific who you are eating, why you are eating, and what you are gaining from eating that individual person. It could be someone you're related to, so you're doing it as part of, as you've said, a funerary rite. It could be your vanquished foe from battle, and you are eating them as a form of honour and to gain their power. Whereas from the European point of view, it's just any old body. I just want the body. So it's sort of the difference between free-range cannibalism and factory cannibalism. So I kind of have a lot of time for that argument. For my choice, I'm just going to give you one last little recipe, and then I'm going to give you my least favourite form of corpse medicine. Sir Francis Bacon, he of the Death by Frozen Chicken, very much believes in the use of usnea, which I talked about before, and one of his contemporaries, the physician and alchemist, two jobs that should not go hand in hand, but did, John French, describes a preparation for a brain tincture, which he describes thusly. Take the brains of a young man that hath died a violent death, together with the membranes, arteries, veins, nerves, and all the pith of the back. Bruise these in a stone mortar till they become a kind of pap. Once mashed, the brain paste was covered in the spirit of wine and then left to digest in horse excrement for 6 months before finally being distilled into a liquid. Where did he get these brains from? Well, from the French army, who were currently fighting, I believe by that time, the Hundred Years' War.
No.
So never trust an army physician.
But then on the flip side, he's got a pretty lengthy supply line.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Over a century
long. And horse manure from the same place. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an integrated supply chain.
But my world's worst medicine comes from another English physician from the 17th century, George Thompson. He was very much a nose-to-tail medical cannibal. And he believed in using every last little bit of the human body and fluid, from urine to menstrual blood, from the brain to the anus. But my two least favourite things that he had was, in order to cure your hemorrhoids, he suggested using the sweat of a dying man.
And it
had to be a man hung on the scaffold. So while everyone else was trying to get their blood, he was there wiping them down with a cloth and wringing it into a bucket. And ideally, the sweat should be removed by the hand of the executioner and then put on the bucket and put on you. But the most ideal thing is this, is that the hand that rubs the sweat of a dying man on your hemorrhoids is the severed hand of the executed victim.
Oh, good Lord.
So, but basically... The Thing from Adam's Family, rubbing a little bit of perspiration over your prolapsed bum.
He'll be a bloody nightmare as well, because they're like, okay, you want the sweat of the dead guy, go ahead and get it. No, actually, would you mind scraping it off for me, please? And actually, while you're at it, before you put that axe away, would you mind chopping that bit off as well? I'm so sorry, I'm a really fussy eater.
It's what he's doing there, essentially, he's not so much applying a medicine to your hemorrhoids as applying a garnish.
Yeah.
Our nominees for the world's worst medicine are Barry's nomination for The Snakeless Snake Oil by Clark Stanley, Tom's nomination of fan favourite, Dr. John Brinkley. I sort of feel, Tom, when you said his name, it was like during the WWE Royal Rumble when you suddenly hear the music of a wrestler who hasn't been in the ring for 20 years. And like, it's Macho Man John R. Brinkley. He's back again, twirling a sock with goat balls around his head.
I mean, the two of you on Zoom, when I did it, it was like one of those videos of like fans when a goal gets scored and then just beer goes everywhere.
Yeah. he's an absolute hero. My nomination of the man wielding a severed hand covered in perspiration, George Thompson. Wow. I didn't think when we did another medical episode we could get more horrifying than we previously had. But, like, Tom, you revealed even more about John Brinkley than we knew. Barry, you uncovered a backstory to possibly the most infamous medicine. And I uncovered a truly disgusting buffet. So, oh, it's tricky. Much as I love John Brinkley, and he is a hero of the show, and he's won before, I'm not sure if I can make him a two-time champion. Because, I was about to say, because goat balls don't strictly count as medicine, which sort of discounts mine as well.
I think, to be fair, none of our suggestions strictly count as medicine.
That's a good point. all of this counts as extremely alternative medicine. I sort of feel we could.
I think that you're missing the word "to" there. An alternative medicine.
Yes. I sort of feel like we can have the three of them as some sort of medical tequila shop where you, like, you lick the perspiration down the snake oil and then bite on a goat testicle.
I mean, between the three of them, like they kind of like you're set for life at that point. You know.
Yeah, you're right. You're potent. You're getting no hemorrhoids, and you've got a cure all.
Yeah. What else do you need?
Oh God, it's hard because I genuinely think George Thompson is more the most revolting of all of them. But I kind of like the snakeless snake oil now I think about it. It's got a great name, it's infamous, and yet the thing that has the name that is used by hucksters was actually useful, and yet you, Barry, have managed to find a non-useful version of that.
Yeah.
So I think for that reason, I am going to go for Clark Stanley's rattlesnake snake oil.
The original and the best.
Yeah. So before we go, we're going to go to the world's best news of the week. Now, listen, this is good news in a very particular frame. We are, of course, we're going to keep giving you the best news until the pandemic is over. I mean, legally, technically, it is in this country, but A, it's not, and B, good Lord above, we need some good news at the moment. This is both good news and an exhortation for you guys to help out. I read on Twitter a couple of days ago about something that many people are doing to help people in Ukraine who are having an awful old time put it ridiculously euphemistically, and rather than donate to humanitarian charities or provide military aid, people have been going on to Airbnb and going to Airbnbs that are owned by people around Ukraine and buying up the properties for a week so that the money can get directly to people whose lives have fallen apart because of the Russian invasion. And there has been just the most beautiful thread on Twitter of the person whose idea it was, the responses they've got from people who aren't just moved by the money, but are moved by the fact that they no longer feel alone because of that. And these people are helping themselves and helping their community. So if you want to help out, and if you have enough money to do something a bit grander, and want to do something which gets money to people in that situation quicker, you can do that. And Airbnb, probably all of their faults as a 21st century online business with no actual property, still making millions out of all of us. In this case, they've done the right thing and they've waived their fees. So So in amongst the absolute hideousness of the fog of war, I liked that story and wanted to share it with you all. Before we go, Tom, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
They can find me on Twitter occasionally, maybe. I'm at Flashboy on that for reasons that are lost in the mist of time that involve the band Suede. Anyway, so I'm there. You can find my books in all good bookshops. So Humans and Truth and Conspiracy will be out in July, I think, not March, as it still says on my website. So yes, Conspiracy come out in March. And that's basically where you'll find me.
Tremendous stuff. We're all off to our local vivarium to see how many snakes we can behead in under 10 minutes. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.